In 1969, an Australian woman named Valerie Taylor got into a shark cage in the Indian Ocean. You've seen them on TV, these floating cages designed to protect divers so they can get up close to these big creatures. Taylor is an icon these days. She's a diver, an underwater cinematographer whose work with sharks really changed our understanding of them. There's a documentary in the Sundance Film Festival this year about her life and her partnership with her husband, Ron. But back then, in 69, Taylor was still guessing at how a shark would behave when humans were in the water with them. Back then, most everyone thought they were just mindless killers. But Valerie had a different idea. In her experience, sharks were not erratic. They were clever. She said they could learn things. She said in that way they were kind of like a dog. The documentary tells the story about this moment. In 1969, they're shooting a documentary with the filmmaker Peter Gimbel, and there's a huge whale carcass in the water. There are hundreds of sharks swimming around. This is the director, Sally Aitken.
The oceanic white-tip shark swims in packs, and they are very dangerous sharks.
We'd never encountered oceanic white-tips before. A species of shark responsible for more human deaths than all the other sharks in the world put together.
And they had actually been filming with those sharks from inside the cage for a few weeks. It was an expedition boat. And Peter Gimbel had decided that they just didn't have enough close-ups. And so, how did they collectively feel about maybe exiting the cage in order to get their close-ups?
When it was decided that we would leave the cage, I thought, we'll die. Now we die. Never for a second did I think of not going.
But they had all observed that the oceanic white-tip shark bumped its object before it attempted to bite it.
And we figured that the shark would bump us before it bit, and if we bumped them back hard, we could make ourselves a place in the pack.
And so they rationalized that if they could bump that shark hard enough back in response, the shark would probably leave them alone. And so they do. They go down in the cage, and then the door opens. And it really is that moment of truth. And they all exit.
We went into another world. A world that existed 20 million years ago. We were accepted as other marine animals come to feed on the whale, but only after we had made a place for ourselves with the pack.
Valerie has a small poking stick, and it is actually her job to fend off any sharks.
It seemed to some just plain foolhardy what they were doing. But what they did in the end was to provide the evidence that if we mind our business, they mind theirs. It's mutual respect.
Ah, you wouldn't believe. You couldn't believe. It's fantastic. Everything happened. They hit the whale and blood went everywhere. Stan and Peter were miles away. They were just surrounded by sharks. And look, There must have been a dozen sharks charging in on them all at once, and then, as Peter said, he just kept his finger on the button and spun in circles. That's all he could do.
What an epiphany. Their theory held up. They did, in fact, bump the sharks back if they bumped them and made a place for themselves in the pack, and they were accepted. That is the perfect example of a pioneering turning point in understanding sharks, and also the historic record of how the ocean once was, and also the great fragility that exists today for sharks and large marine creatures.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Sally Aitken's documentary is called Playing with Sharks. It's premiering at Sundance this year. We'll give you screening information here in a bit. We began our conversation with Aitken in the usual way. How did she find this story about Valerie Taylor?
I just feel so lucky that the story came to me, actually. The origin was that our producer, Bettina Dalton from Wild Bear Entertainment, and Valerie have been a long time friends and also colleagues. And it was when Tina saw Jane Goodall's film around 2018, she suddenly had this epiphany and thought, I know an amazing woman who's got an amazing amount of archive, who's had all these incredible firsthand scientific observations at a time when, you know, quote, layman science wasn't so well respected. And so it was really from that light bulb moment that the film was born. And I was approached, and, of course, as soon as I saw it, one iota of the trajectory of Valerie's life, I was diving right in, Doug.
Yeah. Bettina has written about seeing Valerie on the cover of National Geographic, and she mentioned it being, I think she said it was a lightning bolt or something. She said it was kind of a revelation seeing a woman there on the cover.
Yes, that's right. In fact, my husband, who is Canadian, he remembers seeing Valerie. He was a kid in the 80s, and there she was emblazoned in her medieval armor with the shark. And he remembered that moment being, you know, very electrifying as well. And certainly in Tina's case, it propelled her into a lifetime of making natural history films, certainly. And so it's incredible. I always think of Valerie as a little bit like a Hidden Figures character. She was incredibly well known in Australia in, you know, certainly in the 70s and 80s. But in fact, it's her influence that extends to not just a generation of conservationists today, but actually generations. You know, my 12-year-old is obsessed with her.
So what's she like, Valerie? Of course, we capture all of that in the film, but you've also said that she doesn't suffer fools. So I was wondering, what was it like to sort of wrangle her to be a part of this film?
I have to tell you, it was a little intimidating meeting her for the first time. I thought, geez, I hope she likes me. And I felt, you know, really thrilled. She's a very no-nonsense person. And in the wake of our very first meeting, she sent me a very perfunctory email saying, I think you and I are going to do just great together or something. I thought, oh, I've made it. Fantastic. So far, so good. She's an absolute joy. She really is the epitome of someone who lives life to the fullest with passion, but mostly with purpose. And I admire her so much. I adore her humour. You know, she'll just tell you how it is. It's a particularly Australian quality, I think, but she's got it in spades. And she's so passionate about her beloved and our beloved ocean. It's humbling to witness how much work and labour she still does to this day in terms of raising awareness and advocacy for the marine environment.
So to that point, I mean, when we first meet Valerie in the film, she's packing for a diving trip to Fuji. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But in this moment from the film, she reveals one thing that I think becomes apparent pretty quickly that she just loves going into the water.
I'm going to be wearing a pink wetsuit for the bull sharks, and I used to in the early days, and then I was asked not to wear it anymore because it made me stand out and the bull sharks noticed. Well, I thought that was good, but apparently it's not. I'm looking forward to it because I'll be seeing a lot of good friends. I haven't seen them for more than a year. I usually get out of the water screaming my head off with joy, jumping around. I love it, I love it. And I do, I love it. And maybe I'm a bit funny, actually, but I do. I just love going down there. I love seeing that big bull shark here. Done.
Talk about that love of the water, that sense of enthusiasm, because it does come through, doesn't it?
It really does. I'm sitting here smiling because in my mind's eye, I can see her eyes having lit up even with the very thought of getting in the water with 60-odd bull sharks with no cage. She is someone who has a thirst for adventure. And I think when you meet Valerie in the beginning of the film, what you see is this octogenarian, you know, with slightly gnarled hands. And, you know, you think, what? Sorry? Excuse me? You're going diving with bull sharks. What's going on here? You know? So it's that lovely juxtaposition of, okay, we might be in for a surprise with this character. She's a little unorthodox, and she certainly is.
Sally, is it a theme in the book, in the film, a kind of a visual theme in some ways? This older woman moving on the land compared to a younger one moving in the sea, that juxtaposition seemed important to you.
That's a really interesting observation. There is a juxtaposition there, you're right, and it is conscious. It's the intercut between the older, beautiful, sage wisdom of someone who has really seen a lot and done a lot, and that is cut against, you know, albeit the much more physically able and active and, kinetic, if you will, character. Mm-hmm. But it's something really universal for all of us because in that intercut, you see a life. You know, the younger self doesn't know what the older self is going to know, and the older self doesn't know when they're younger what lies in store. And so there's something just ripe with emotion for that for me, because actually that's for all of us. That's about life. That is about how we choose to live our lives and where we choose to put our energies and why we choose to have the passions that we do.
You tell the story in the film of this experience she had when she was a young girl, really seemed to kind of form her sense of the world. So she's diagnosed with polio and confined to a hospital. Tell us a little bit about that experience and how that seems to shape her. I mean, she hates it. She hates being confined. It's hard to even imagine it, knowing kind of who she is now.
That's right. From a woman whose, you know, favorite happy place is mixing it up with large toothy predators. The idea of being immobile is, it's an anathema. But you're right. It was in the post-war period, one of the last polio outbreaks, actually, and she contracted polio when she was 12, so she was on the cusp of teenagehood, and she was paralyzed. You know, she says she remembers literally one day being able to ride her bike to school, and the next morning woke up and she just couldn't move a limb, and she knew instantly what it was. How could you not? It was in the news. And so the double terror for a 12-year-old is not only do you have this really scary virus, but you're actually put in isolation. So she was taken off to hospital and taken away from her, mother and father, whom whom she adored, and obviously that's because it's highly infectious. And it was when she was in the hospital, and at that time there was actually a fairly radical, it's almost like the origins of physiotherapy, actually, an Australian nurse, interestingly enough, Sister Kenny, had this fairly unorthodox for the time. It's now, of course, orthodox, but a treatment program in which once you had recovered from the virus, you know, to reignite the limbs and to massage the limbs and to get them moving. And so Valerie talks about how they she received books, and she was determined to turn the pages of the books. And as soon as she could turn a page, they'd slap a lead bracelet on her arm, so then it was like even harder to turn the page of the book. But it was those books that actually gave her the flight of imagination and the possibility that adventure lied out there for those who were able to seize it, because she was given all these boys' own adventure annuals, and Huckleberry Finn and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And I mean, not forgetting these are all, you know, male heroes. Nonetheless, she was like, I'm going to do that. Yeah. You know, and so it's interesting how these formative experiences in our childhood, in our childhoods really, can totally, fundamentally shape the people we become. And certainly that was true for Valerie, because she willed herself to walk out of that hospital so she could go and have the adventures that she'd read about.
Here's another moment from the film. This is what Valerie is telling about when the world, you know, the world beneath the ocean really grabs hold of her.
The first time I ever could see underwater, I was 14 years old, and I saw a piece of kelp. I thought it was amazing. It was going to and fro. And I knew I had to see more. I would slide into the water from the world that we all know into another world, a different world, alien.
What was she seeing there, do you think? Was it just the adventure of a new world? Was it the strangeness of it? What do you think it was?
I think it's both of those. I think it was the idea of exploration. You know, it's so interesting, yeah. Doug. I'm sitting here. I'm actually looking out at the ocean right now, to the surf, in fact, crashing against the rocks. And, you know, for so many of us, we know what the ocean looks like on the surface. And for Valerie, in that moment, what she had was the opportunity to be underneath. And what's also interesting is, you know, she and her family, you know, they really did everything themselves. They had very, very little money. And the first face mask that she ever put on was homemade. Because that's what you did in the mid-50s down here in Australia and New Zealand. And so for me, there's such a combination of a kind of a moment of great realization that there is this whole other world to be explored and respected and understood. And Valerie got that the second she put a face mask on that had been made for her by a 14-year-old boy. And and it's so lovely hearing the clips. I wish the listeners could see what's in the film at the same time, because what accompanies that audio are the most extraordinary early images that were capable, you know, with underwater filmmaking technology and in colour too on film. And it's just rich and beautiful and, yeah, makes me feel really lovely hearing it. So thank you.
Sally Aitken, she's the director of Playing with Sharks, which premieres at this year's Sundance Film Festival. You can get information on screenings on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Last year, people took to the streets in cities across the U.S. to protest against police brutality and for racial justice. That conversation is still happening, including here in Utah. I'm Emily Means.
And I'm Sonia Hudson. On this week's 45 Days, we're going to see how state lawmakers are answering the calls from protesters to hold police accountable.
Listen to 45 Days for free wherever you listen to podcasts, or just go to 45days.org.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. We're focusing on some of the films at the Sundance Film Festival this week. It's an online affair this year, just got underway last night. Our guest this hour is the filmmaker Sally Aitken. Her film is Playing with Sharks. It's in the documentary competition this year, and it's about this remarkable woman named Valerie Taylor. Taylor is a diver and an underwater photographer, and her work, along with her husband Ron, really transformed our popular and scientific ideas about sharks. The impression of them being terrible, indiscriminate killers was pretty hard to shake. It still is. There's this sequence, and you have footage of it, where we see Valerie kill a shark. Now, and we should mention that she begins her experience in the sea as a hunter. She's really good, amazing at spearfishing. And this moment where she kills that shark reveals kind of an important idea in the film that I wanted to ask you about, that there was such, as you said, there was such abundance in those days in the ocean that no one was thinking about the consequences of killing as many fish as you wanted.
I never killed one shark. I wish I hadn't, but at the time, there was no one to say, this is a bad thing. And he said, oh, very good. Killed a lot of fish. The attitude was there was so much life in the ocean. You could take what you wanted and never make a difference.
This comes up a few times in the film, this idea of abundance. Say something about that, would you?
Yes, it's, you know, you don't know what you don't know, right?
Yep.
And
yep.
It's truly gobsmacking for us today. And it was true for myself and my editor and some of our team. When we look at the footage, it's an amazing world, the spearfishing world of the 1950s in Australia. You know, there were clubs all up and down the coast. And the take from the ocean, you know, in the name of sport. And I might add, you know, this is a mere dint to what is actually happening in terms of overfishing our oceans today still.
Right.
But certainly for Valerie personally, she was part of, you know, this great fun club environment in which no one even considered that the actions of spearing fish was going to impact the ability to do so in the future. And it is really only now with our modern eyes, we look at these images of these huge fish being taken and you just think, how did they even see them, let alone catch them? Do you know what I mean? And so what is true in Valerie's trajectory is she is really living the Anthropocene. She didn't know it, you know, none of us did, but she is born at a time when human impact starts to be really making a difference in our natural environment. And it is through her own very early realization of that damage that she became such a radical conservationist at a time when conservation wasn't even a word. You know, it's very par for the course today. Oh, yeah, we understand, you know, and yet we're still taking too much. And certainly back then, it was conservation, what's that, you know?
Yeah. What's the first shark that Valerie saw? And what did she think of it?
The first shark Valerie encountered that she saw was a grey nurse shark. And it is a very fearsome looking shark. It has literally teeth hanging out of its jaws, and it lurks in caves and around, you know, the rocky coast. And they're completely harmless. But no one thought so at the time.
But she was terrified, though, right? I mean, she thought she'd be attacked at any minute, I guess, when she saw
Absolutely. Well, you know, that's all you've heard in the newsreels and the headlines of the day. You know, shark is just simply associated with monster. And so, yes, she couldn't get out of the water fast enough. And she got out and she was like, oh, it didn't actually come and attack us. And then, you know, it's those small beginnings, isn't it? You know, the more she immersed herself in the ocean and the more fish she speared, because fish bring in sharks, the more she was able to witness shark behavior and start to realize, oh, I think I understand. You know, they're actually maybe not so interested in me. It's fascinating. There's some early archive that we didn't end up using in the film, but I really wanted to and just couldn't make it fit. But it's very early on. It's filmed in black and white. And she must be about 24. She's at the top of her game as a spear fisher, and she's interviewed, and she's told, she tells the interviewer the different species of sharks and which ones she will, you know, ignore and which ones she might give the fish over to. And, you know, I think, oh, really, in the span of a couple of years, you know, she had encountered a number of species and really started to sort that out. You know, today we barely know that there's multiple species of sharks, you know. So yeah, you learn a lot in the film, and I've certainly learned an enormous amount in making the film.
Some of the film is a love story, which I really liked. Let's talk about Ron Taylor, her husband, champion spear fisherman. She was the woman spearfishing champion. He was the man spearfishing champion, top of the trade, as she said. They were kind of a power couple, I guess. Talk a little bit about the relationship and the attraction, what it is they shared.
Well, Ron was also from very humble beginnings. He had left school, like Valerie, very early without any, you know, formal education. And he had been apprenticing in a photography studio and just sort of started to become interested in cameras. But at the weekends, he, you know, as his leisure pastime was wont to be, he would be out there with his spearfishing club and winning all the titles, and at one time the world title. And it was through the spearfishing club that Ron and Valerie meet. And he asks her to do a bit of, she says, posing. I think he said, you know, will you just help me? I'm trying to do some filming. And I think, you know, a great love affair was born, mostly because they did share this passion for discovering the underwater world. And when they realized that, hey, it was actually a pretty good fit, Valerie in front of the camera and Ron behind the camera, that I think, you know, the professional and the personal relationships started to meld. They had an incredible relationship for more than 50 years, and it was one of mutual respect and deep love and shared love for the ocean.
Friend of theirs had been bitten by a great white shark, Rodney Fox, and we see in the film him talking about this. And it seems to begin their interest in knowing more about these bigger sharks, about great whites. We should say people didn't know much about great whites then. I mean, and no one had filmed them underwater. And so as we see in the film, Ron goes on this expedition to film them. And Valerie, she wasn't allowed to go. They didn't want a woman in the expedition, which is another thing. But Ron manages to capture the first images of a great white. A great white. So let me play another moment from this film. This is Ron Taylor, Valerie's husband and their friend, the diver Rodney Fox.
The very first time I saw it, the hair stood up on the back of my neck because it was such a big shark. Mean-looking shark.
Ron actually sat on the duck board at the back filming some footage and saw submarines with teeth.
One of the best lines in the film, I have to say. And isn't it the truth? I mean, it's extraordinary. So these were the first images that we have of great whites under the water, I guess.
That's right. I mean, it is still unfathomable to me. Rodney Fox, their very great friend, a spearfishing champion himself from South Australia, and Ron and Valerie from New South Wales, which is on the eastern coast. They had, they'd met through the spearing clubs, and Rodney had been attacked by a great white literally about 18 months before all that expedition was planned, and he very nearly lost his life. I mean, the wounds were horrific. He was incredibly lucky to have been, let go and to stem the bleeding and get to hospital. I think he had something like 495 stitches or something from memory. But the idea that then Rodney and Ron decide that, yes, they're going to go back and have a great white shark expedition, that is extraordinary to me. And then knowing what had happened to Rodney, Ron being the kind of person he was, they had thought about trying to put a cage in, and I believe Rodney had sort of jimmied up a very, very rudimentary cage as well. But Ron, it was too small and Ron couldn't get his camera in. And anyway, Ron decides that he's going to lean over the back of the boat, and he has his foot tied on with a rope. I mean, you have to say it. It's just ridiculous. And he puts his head in and waits for the sharks to come as close to his camera as he allows and, then rises up again to draw breath and then down again for the next take. I mean, holding your nerve, let alone making sure that, you've got enough reel. It's amazing to me, and the images are incredible, and it is those images that Ron captured that electrified the world. They went round the world. They made every magazine of the day, and indeed you see that image repeated actually in some subsequent Hollywood films, not the least Blue Water White Death, which came a few years later, because they had seen this footage, and then, of course, Jaws. So that pioneering footage, which was achieved in such an incredible way and is extraordinary to look at, just very nearly wasn't to be. And it's amazing to me that they went out and did it. And, yes, Valerie wasn't allowed. I mean, come on. She knew about sharks just as well. So,
Yeah. So she's not even there, but it turns out to be a turning point in her life, because after they filmed those sharks underneath, the man who owned the boat or was part of the expedition thought that they needed to then kill as many as they could. Mm-hmm. So talk about that part, because this is an important part in this story. As Valerie said, it was just after that kill.
Mm. They just, all of them actually, Rodney included, I think they looked at these magnificent creatures and thought, what are we doing? And by extension, she and Ron put down their spears and literally decided to exclusively focus on their cameras. That you know, great things do come from personal epiphanies, don't they? Think absolutely it was a moment of deep realization that they had just filmed these incredible images and that was enough. You know, there was no need to further conquer. It's a very important moment in which they very actively decide that they're not going to be involved in hunting any longer.
Well, let me place something from this part in the film, because you include in the documentary the great ocean explorer and scientist, Dr. Sylvia Earle, who talks about this shift that comes from this story of Valerie and Ron having this personal experience. Mm. So here's another moment from the film. We'll hear Valerie and Dr. Sylvia Earle.
I thought it was sad. Really changed the way I looked at the world and spearfishing. After that, Ron said, actually, killing fish upsets me. I'm not doing this anymore. We put our spears down and never did another competition again. We said, from now on, I'm shooting them with my camera.
It was personal revelation that made that transition. Experience that convinced them. It wasn't somebody telling them, they could see for themselves. And I admire that.
What do you think she was getting at there, Dr. Earle, the idea of personal revelation, that it was from their own personal experience that they could make this decision, I guess?
That's exactly right. It's a little quirk. It's lovely. Valerie and Sylvia were born in exactly the same year. And so, as Sylvia says, you know, they've both been a witness to the change in the ocean. And it's true, I think, when you say that Sylvia is picking up on that personal epiphany. It is the idea that you yourself have been responsible for something and you then yourself responsibly decide to do something about it. And in this case, change your mind.
I think it's important to say also, as you point out in the film, Valerie and Ron were pioneers in understanding these creatures. But they were not, like Dr. Earle, you know, marine biologists. I mean, they didn't come to this with academic qualifications. They didn't have institutional support. I mean, this was a DIY operation for the most part.
It was so DIY. Not only did they not come from scientific backgrounds, they didn't even have high school certificate, Doug. You know, but it is absolutely true that they are scientists. They are scientists in what they have seen and experienced. And Valerie is always very swift to say, you know, I'm not a scientist. I don't have formal qualifications. Actually, she has contributed to a number of scientific papers. And what she and Ron have seen and documented over their years in the marine environment, it is actually today that people are looking back at some of those things and realizing the great significance of them. I'll give you an example. You know, years ago, decades ago, they had filmed what's known as a walking shark, which is literally a shark that's on the bottom of the ocean floor and walks along on its fins. It was literally only, I think it was 2013, someone had published, you know, the great discovery of the walking shark. She was like, we filmed that back in the 70s. What are you talking about? There are so many examples of that. She had seen ponyfish, which light up. And no, the scientist who had studied these fish had never seen that. And so he made Valerie take him back to the very place that she'd seen these things. So whilst they may not have a PhD, you know, before or after their names, that what they have seen and certainly how they have observed those things is of the scientific record. And interestingly enough, we can use the footage today. There's an amazing project that Valerie is working on with the University of New South Wales, in which we are looking back at the early footage, not just for what's in the front of the frame, but actually what's behind. And it's a way of recording a baseline. And so you're looking at the sponges on the wall of a rock cave or the number of urchins. And so they are able to use the film that was never taken originally for scientific purposes, but today is invaluable for the scientific record. And I think that's a fantastic legacy.
Let's talk a little bit about Valerie's role in the making of the blockbuster movie Jaws in 1975. We don't need to give everything away about that because it's a delightful part of the film in some ways, I have to say. Just the process, the behind-the-scenes process of shooting these scenes. But remind people what a phenomenon that movie was and talk a little bit about the impact that it has.
Look, you know, it's so interesting, isn't it? We say blockbuster. Nobody at the time that they were all embarking on that incredible movie had any inkling it was going to be a blockbuster. The, you know, it was Steven Spielberg's second film. He was basically unknown. The incredible connection is that, as I said, all the way back to that very early footage that Ron Taylor had recorded of the great whites swimming towards his camera with his teeth open, had galvanized Peter Gimble to make Blue Water White Death, and that movie in turn galvanized Pete Benchley, who was the author of Jaws, of course, and it was Peter's novel that had excited Richard Brown and David Zanuck from Universal Pictures, the producers, and they approached Ron and Valerie and asked their opinion, you know, what did they think? Would this make a good story? Would it be something that people wanted to watch? And Ron and Valerie knew that people had really enjoyed watching their shark documentaries, and so they, yes, thought probably it was a good idea. And, you know, Steven Spielberg was engaged, and the incredible, you know, movie was born. But Ron and Valerie were engaged not only to consult in the movie, but also to consult. Ron flew to Hollywood a few times to consult on the process of having a mechanical shark, and certainly Ron and Valerie were engaged to go out with Rodney Fox, the Great White Shark Expedition organizer from the footage that Ron had taken earlier, to go and film all the live shark footage for Jaws. And it is in the incredible making of scenes, the behind-the-scenes stories, as you say, Doug, of the footage that Ron and Valerie and Rodney achieved in South Australia in 1974, and how that footage becomes incorporated into the final movie. And it's brilliant intercut between the behind the scenes and the movie itself. And then, of course, the unbelievable reaction from ticket sales, the idea of a blockbuster movie, and alas, the huge impact that it had in terms of people's perceptions of sharks, which Ron and Valerie just couldn't believe.
Couldn't believe, horrified by, turned sharks into, they'd always been terrifying, but now this made them even more like demons. And it seems, Sally, that for the rest of her life, or even now, she's in some ways trying to atone for the misperceptions that were cast in that film.
Ron and Valerie, that they knew the real shark. They knew what great whites looked like, what they were capable of, what their behaviors were. And so they couldn't reconcile the idea that other people didn't, you know. And as I think she says in the film, you know, you don't go and watch King Kong and then go and expect to see a giant gorilla when you go to New York. She just couldn't believe that such hysteria, you know, came as a result of the film. And yes, I think they felt incredibly responsible and upset by that involvement, that inadvertently they might have been part of a misconception, and indeed worked incredibly hard thereafter to transform our understanding once more of sharks, and in particular the demonized great white. And she is still doing that to this day.
Yeah. I want to ask you about one final moment from the film. And it's a visual. It's something that we see. We have throughout this documentary being seen a young woman fluidly working her way through the ocean, putting on her flippers, excitedly jumping into the water. And we see a scene of her trying to put on an older, more frail, of course, 85-year-old woman trying to put on a wetsuit, having to be helped. And it's such a powerful image and a contrast. Would you say something about that finally? Because I think it gets at that thing you were mentioning before, that we kind of see in that arc, that journey of a life.
It's so emotional, isn't it? You know, what we once were, what we are today. You know, it's incredible to have had the opportunity to see that in the same image, because we have this wealth of archive and all these incredible pictures of Valerie from her youth. And we were able, so happily, before COVID hit, to travel to Fiji and film Valerie diving. You know, this is actually the longest period of time since she actually hasn't been able to get on a dive boat. She's itching to get back. She's still as passionate as ever, and, you know, will keep diving for as long as she is able. And it is the as long as she is able that is profoundly there in that moment, because she does have arthritis. And so it is incredibly difficult for her to put the wetsuit on, and all the gear is incredibly heavy and so on. And happily for Valerie, she actually has Mr. Fiji as her dive buddy, a marine biologist, Ben Sagatar, who's lovely and handsome. Nothing but a little opportunity to have a little flirtation along the way. And we intercut this, you know, contemporary reality of being assisted and so on with, of course, the past. And for me, I just think there's such a profundity in seeing, you know, that the younger self never meets the older self, you know, and the older self never meets the younger self in real life. And yet in the movie, we're able to do that. And that's universal for all of us, I think. You know, you see what you can be, and you see where you've come from. It's beautiful. And then when she's in the water, she's away. She's weightless. She can fly.
Sally Aitken, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
That's Sally Aitken. Her film is Playing with Sharks, and it's in the World Cinema Documentary Competition at the Sundance Film Festival this year. You can get information about how to watch it or any of the others from the festival by going to our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Aaron Camargo, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.